Hey everybody, welcome to Back Issues. Today we're gonna have kind of a chill stream, you know, just kind of sit back and talk about, well, at least for me and John, one of our favorite comic books. John, you know what, man, you introduce it.
Oh, absolutely. I am more than happy to introduce this. You might have heard me in the past on this wonderful podcast talk about what I consider to be the holy trinity of comic books. Two of them we've already talked about, one being Transmetropolitan, the other being Preacher. This, though, the third one, my favourite comic ever, quite possibly one of my favourite forms of media ever. This is Sandman.
All right, we're talking 1989 to 1993, 75-issue run, every issue written by Neil Gaiman, with a list of pencilers and inkers and stuff that would take an hour to read on its own. Yeah. This was quintessential Vertigo in the early 90s.
This is actually what got Vertigo started.
Yeah.
Sandman. Basically, Sandman, originally, was part of the DC universe, but the first six issues, like, Martian Manhunter's in it, Constantine's in
Scott
it.
Scott Free.
Yep, Dr. D is in it. Scarecrow as well in Arkham. Yeah, there's this whole like, oh yes, it's part of the DC universe. Until it got gradually more and more messed up until they realised, this really doesn't fit the tone of DC. I mean, DC's dark, but this, holy shit, this is dark. So Vertigo was created as this kind of like, let's just have it kind of mingle with the DC universe, but also be on its own, until eventually it became its completely own separate branding of books.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, in the last, like, you know, it splits off from the main DC universe, let's say at about issue 8 or so.
Yeah, right. Around then, yeah.
But during the wake, you see Batman, you see Martian Manhunter again, and you see Superman in his civilian identity.
That's right, yeah.
So while it's not part of DC, it still is.
Yeah, it's weird. And some of the characters as well, particularly Death, we'll come to talk a lot about. He is kind of the most powerful version of Death, but she's very rarely used in the DC.
Which is really good.
Oh, yeah, because there's other versions of Death, like there's the Black Racer and stuff, and there's Death, you know, with a small D. Well, but they're kind of used as, you know, it sounds weird to say, but they're kind of used as day-to-day Death. Whereas Death from Sandman is, like, the ultimate version of, you know, this is the real motherfucker here.
Well, I think we should start this off by talking about the titular character. He's commonly called Morpheus in the comics, or, you know, any various iteration of the folklore or pantheological figure of, you know, Dream. So, yeah, the titular character, he's a broody little bastard, but he's the greatest broody little bastard.
And it looks like Robert Smith from me.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have this group of, how do we put this? Fuck that word. They're beings based.
Anthropomorphic.
Yeah, there we go, thank you. Anthropomorphic beings based off of facets of the living condition.
In Marvel, they're known as conceptual beings.
Oh, yeah, well, fuck Marvel.
Yeah,
well, yeah, anyway. Fuck Marvel, but...
So, basically, as Jason was saying, they're a family.
Yeah.
Seven siblings. And, well, let me see. Dick, can you name the seven endless? See how well you've studied.
Death, Despair, Dream... Destruction, and I'm trying to remember the other one. They were Delight, I think, right? Or I think I have that. I can't remember the name, though. It's not coming up for me right now. Sorry, I'm a little tired right now.
Yeah, you're missing, like, three.
Wow.
You're missing Desire, Despair, and Delirium.
There we go. Those are the ones I'm missing.
But yeah, let's start with the simplest one, Dream. He looks like Robert Smith, cloaked in a shapeless cloak of night with, you know, flames dancing in it. His eyes are completely just shadow with like a hint of light inside. He's basically every goth girl's dream.
Yeah, pretty much. If it has black eye goo and wears too much black and has dyed hair, it'll probably gush at the sight of Dream. I'm not gonna lie.
It reminds me a lot of how I thought Tim Burton would have been in the late 80s. Just like, oh, I'm so goth, I'm so like artsy, and I've got all this stuff. But I mean, that kind of is the point of the character, really, because the whole run, the whole Sandman comic book, is basically about this character, Dream, realizing that he's kind of a dick and then attempting to get better. That's basically the entire story of the comic book.
He constantly fucks people over, but he doesn't mean to, for the most part.
Exactly, and he kind of realizes what he's been doing throughout his whole existence, up until there's an event that kicks the comic book off, which is he gets summoned by this black magic. Basically like Aleister Crowley kind of thing, you know, the cult summon him. They actually mean to summon Death so they can, you know, be mortal. But instead they summon Death's brother, Dream. And that realized that he's kept in a glass cage for about 80 years. And then from that he realizes, hang on, I've really been kind of a horrible person throughout my entire life. After that point, when he starts fucking people over, he's like, oh, that's actually not a good thing to do. And that's where it gets a bit self-realization, and Brian is becoming a better, well, not person, but a better anthropomorphic entity.
Yeah. All right, let's kick into the other ones. Let's start with, you know, the second biggest member of the Endless, Death. She looks like, you know, early 90s, late 80s Tori Amos.
Yeah.
You know, she always has, you know, the silver ankh and everything, you know, the eye makeup. Like the Eye of Horus makeup, actually. Death is not what you'd expect from Death. She is a happy, bubbly person who literally takes no end of joy in having conversations and interactions with the newly departed. You know, she's like, you die, there's this goth girl, and she just runs up and hugs you kind of thing. I mean, she's a great character and completely opposite what you'd think of Death. She more represents not the end, but the beginning of something new. And it's said that, it said she'll be the last thing left when the universe dies. You know, put the chairs up, turn off the light, and leave kind of thing.
She is one of the most interesting and fascinating characters in anything I've ever read or watched or played or anything. I actually have a, Jason, you'll be familiar with this, but I've got a tattoo of Death.
I want your tattoo.
It's like basically a half sleeve, just of the character, and with the ankh and the eye makeup and everything. And I got it because she's so, like you say, she's so happy about everything, even though she's personification of the end of life. That's not what she's about at all. She just takes joy in the process of it. She takes joy in every single person or being or creature that dies, be they, you know, from Earth or any other planet or any dimension that she's got access to. She meets them and, like, talks to them about their life and about what's going on and about what the next step is. And despite all this, she's been going for more or less the start of the universe until the comic. So just happy about everything. Incredible to read a character like that. Really. so different to what you'd imagine Death to be like. She's a bit goth. She does have the black hair and a lot of eye makeup and an ank. But aside from that, she's just not like any depiction of Death been before.
And what's really interesting about her is I think of all the Endless, she's the most level-headed.
Definitely the most human.
Yeah, she's always the one that looks through and says, don't you see what they're doing trying to play you against, you know, like picking out the little games and politics and just sitting there saying, why don't you see through all this? She's like, she's so clear-headed about everything. It's amazing. And you say, you know, she takes pride and joy in what she does, but I think it really needs to be stressed. She doesn't take any kind of weird or perverse joy in it. She just wants to be there for the people during the transition.
Exactly. At the end of the first trade, Death's just escaped from the captors that caught him in the cell. And he's kind of had the first couple of ventures where he's gone and rescued some people and he's gone and tried to get his old life back. Kind of reflecting on it and it's like, oh, I was trapped for so long, it was rubbish. And this is the first introduction of Death. I think it's like a teenager gets hit by a car.
Mm.
And she's there to, you know, obviously to meet this person and do her job. And she basically, Death sat there just going, oh yeah, I've had all this stuff happen to me, it's been rubbish, and I got caught, and I've been in this thing.
You mean Dream? Death just, you said Death.
Oh, sorry, yes, Dream. Yeah. Sorry, yes. And Death just basically turns to him and says, shut the fuck up, lighten up, you moody bastard, and just, we're endless, we're these, like, more powerful than gods, just stop whining and get on with it. Do your job. And it's just amazing. That's the moment I fell in love with her, because it's just this character just being so cut through the bullshit and just, yeah, this is what I'm doing. I know this is what I need to do, and there's no point being upset or, you know, angry about it, because this is what I'm designed to do.
Yeah. Now, I think after that, I think the next most prominent character would actually be Desire. I mean, figures into a number of, you know, storylines, and it loves to fuck with Dream throughout the series and throughout history, as they show in the series.
Yeah, I guess Desire is probably the nearest thing to a bad guy this comic has, but not really. Like, Desire is whoever's looking at Desire, you see what your Desire is. So Desire isn't a he or a she. Desire is just a thing. And every time Dream sees Desire, it's usually a woman, I guess.
No. She always shows up as something in between. You know, an androgynous being.
Very 80s.
Granted, they do say... It is capable of showing up as male, female, you know, whatever the person perceiving them desires.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's something that really should be mentioned about all these characters. If you were to encounter them, they would look like your idea of them. They don't have true forms, really, except for with each other. Like when Martian Manhunter meets Dream early on, and sees this Martian god.
Yeah, that's something that I actually got. So this is how much I love the Sandman. I've got the annotated.
I'm jealous of that.
It's so good. So what that is, it's the comic, you know, as it is. But then after the traditional trade ends, a load of notes on the script and stuff. From one interview, Neil Gaiman said, well, I don't really know what the characters look like, but in a comic, for the most part, it's just what I would see if I was to meet them. So again, like, it's kind of a weird, we're seeing someone else's perspective of the characters as well, which is really cool, I think, because that's like, actually, we don't know what they look like if we saw them. They might look completely different. Because I think as well, a lot of the... Like you say, Death looks like Tori Amos. Scream looks like Robert Smith. As well as that, Lucifer, is quite an important secondary character, looks like David Bowie. You turn the page and it's like, oh shit, that's David Bowie.
Alternately, you could also say Desire is taking the place of any number of 80s musicians.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff like, your woman from Eurythmics.
Yeah.
Yeah, she like, you can see that definite influences in that as well. And it's just interesting to see that how they draw it differently, because in Desire's case, so each of the Endless have their own realms, and it's very tailored to them. So Dream's realm is full of just completely off-the-wall, batshit crazy things that people over the years or aliens have dreamed about. And he's gone, oh, that's pretty cool, and put it in his realm. So his castle is, you know, built on people's dreams, and it's got this weird architecture that doesn't quite make sense, like a dream. Desire's realm is just a huge statue of Desire that she lives in, or he lives in.
Specifically in the heart.
Specifically in the heart, yeah. Obviously, it's a very big, complicated metaphor. But it's just interesting to, like, that's another aspect of their characters, is what kind of thing they live in. Briefly see Death's realm, only really briefly. And it's
isn't it
normal,
like, yeah, it's just like a normal room with a goldfish bowl in it.
It's just a house, just a normal, like two-bedroom house. It's really, like, just normal and plain, which totally fits with the character, because she'd totally live there.
With the universe's oldest goldfish.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, Desire likes to play games among their siblings. And they have a severe cruel streak, because let's face it, desire is a cruel emotion.
It's very, well, we'll come back to it, but it's very destructive.
Yep.
A lot of times it can lead you to do some pretty nasty things, which it does throughout the book. Dick, what did you think of Desire?
Ultimately, it was a very good personification of the concept of desire. The keeping the character androgynous and the art kind of reflecting that very well, actually. From certain angles, it looks very masculine, from others feminine and things like that. And it really, it takes a look at the very basic idea of what humanity perceives desire as, and how that really ties in very much to sexual overtones. But in addition to that, it also, you know, plays into a lot of, you know, people realizing their idealized self. And in a way, it plays off the idea that desire is a byproduct of narcissism, almost. And that's one of the biggest things that I really took away from the character. I liked it. I liked the way that Neil wrote Desire. Kind of a dick, though.
Yeah, I can agree. Well, and the counterpoint to Desire is actually their twin, Despair. Despair has had a really interesting backstory. Despair is actually not the first Despair. The first Despair was actually more talkative and self-assured, as opposed to, you know, a bloated, kind of constantly depressed woman. The first Despair, they hint that, I think it was in Endless Nights, wasn't it, John? They hint Despair might have been responsible for Krypton exploding.
Yeah, this is a common theme throughout the book, is this idea of the same personification, but a different person.
Yeah.
So the idea with, which is only really hinted at throughout the book, it was mentioned a couple of times in the main run, and you're never really given any context for it. It's just like, oh, the first Despair. And you're like, wait, what? And you never really find out about it. Again, like you say, in Endless Nights, which is kind of like a little anthology which came out years after the series had ended, find out a little bit more about it, but not a whole lot. You just see it kind of at a party, and that's about it, really. It's really interesting, this idea of taking the place of other previous incarnations. The very important thing that comes in at the end of the run as a whole, but as well, characters like Matthew.
I love Matthew.
so good. And you made well aware that he's like the third or fourth Raven.
Oh, they, later on, don't they say that it's like a countless number? They've lost count over the years.
Yes. So he starts off as by saying like, oh, I'm like the third or fourth or something. That's what Matthew thinks he is. And then eventually finds out there's been almost infinite. Not almost infinite. That doesn't make sense.
And it's an aside, and I know the listeners are going to be confused, but I love the revelation that Lucien was the first Raven.
Yes. That's fun. That was fantastic.
Lucien is a great character, though.
Lucien is great.
We'll get to him after we finish with the Endless.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because I do want to go into the bit of some of the denizens of the Dreaming, because they're just crazy.
Oh, they really are. There's, but that idea of the rebirth, that Despair was, again, not the first one. It makes you kind of think, oh, that's interesting. And actually, yeah, it becomes a very, very big story point for a lot of the characters later on. The whole, especially Dream, get to in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to put an addendum to the Endless for that one. Don't worry.
Absolutely good stuff.
But what I really like about Despair and hate about Despair is she's always naked.
Yeah,
but it makes sense when you think about it, because, dude, I'm gonna be hitting close to home. But you and I, we share one major thing. We both have mental disorders that have caused us to be more in Despair's realm than we'd like.
Absolutely, yes.
But when you feel that grip of true despair, you feel naked.
Oh, totally. And one of the main things that that she's always doing, she's got this ring. Like a hook on it, and she's always just tearing at her flesh.
Because despair puts its hooks into you.
Exactly, and it always makes you self-destructive. So that it's interesting how one kind of aspect of this can lead to another. You know, one of the Endless can lead to another one of the Endless. Like,
mm-hmm.
Again, that's a very big cyclical theme of the book, is like, there's these seven personifications, and one can very easily slip to another, from going from despair to delight.
Mm-hmm.
She is
delirium.
Comic delirium.
In fact, let's talk about delirium. Honestly,
oh my god,
my favorite of the Endless, with the exception of the two main ones.
Delirium is just like so amazing.
She never looks the same in two consecutive panels, too. Constantly changing.
One of the best things about her is all the Endless have got different speech bubbles, so they're all very unique.
Yeah.
Dreams is like reverse, so it's black speech bubbles with white text, so, you know, the opposite to what you normally expect.
Yeah.
Death is just normal, which is obviously in keeping with the character. Delirium, though, hers is just completely like, almost like tie-dye, different colors all over the place. They drip, they have different bubbles, just like...
The font constantly changes.
Yeah, it's just like an idea of just... Basically, she represents insanity.
Yep.
At one point, she's the youngest of the Endless, and at one point in her existence, she was the light. And again, see a very, very brief segment where she is the light, and she looks like a normal woman.
And she's really happy.
Really happy. While she's delirium, though, she's not. Her mood changes instantly.
Yeah.
And she's almost like a child in the...
a bipolar child. That'd be the way I'd put it.
At one point, there's a guy who, he does something really minor to it. Like, I can't remember what he does, but he like, just nudges her or says something wrong. And she goes, right, from now until the day you die, you're cursed with having insects all over your body that only you can see. And just does that and then forgets about it. So that guy is like basically cursed for life.
And what I really like, you know, when she's looking for her dog comes across the old homeless guy with the dog, and she's like, I should give you something nice. And he just looks at her and says, I'm already one of your people. I know that a gift from somebody like us is not a gift. That, you know, to be touched by insanity is not a good thing.
Oh, it's not.
Which is, I'll be honest, I am the resident crazy person. It's not a good thing. It sucks. but over the years I've come to love her.
She's quite lovable. She's like someone that you know you shouldn't get in a relationship with, but you kind of do anyway, and then you're like, shouldn't do this, but kind of awesome.
I know you're going to be unhealthy for me, but damn that ass.
That's
kind of
exactly what
it's like. All right. Destiny, honestly, the most stodgy of the endless. I mean, the dude
walks around his garden with a book.
Yeah, walks around his garden with a book dressed in, you know, gray or brown robes, just reading this book in which all of existence is written.
He was said to be the first of the endless.
Yeah. I'll be honest, he's more of a plot device than anything.
Yeah, and he's never really used that much. He's just kind of referenced. So basically, he looks like this old guy with a book that he's chained to.
He's blind, yep.
He's completely blind. Said that everything that ever will happen in the universe is in his book. And if it doesn't happen, it's not in the book. And only things that are going to happen will be in the book. And if it's not in the book, it's not possible. You can't change destiny.
Exactly. And along with that, Destiny, you know, he's a lot more into his function, you know? He's very work-minded. He does nothing but sit and read that book.
He takes his job very seriously.
And he has very little actual personality.
Yeah, it's never. You find out probably the least about Destiny. Just because he's always just walking around the garden and he doesn't say much. There's one point where some of the characters go and try and ask him something, and it's just like, yeah, if it's going to happen, then it'll happen. That's all he's pretty much all he says.
It's like, I brought you here because you need to be here right now.
Yeah.
That's it.
And it's kind of that thing, whenever there's a time travel movie or something like that, they always say, I knew you were going to say that because I've already answered it. And that's just exactly what he does. Like, well, I'm going to say this now because I know I'm going to say it. And then you're going to have this response, so I'm going to have this response. And that's all that will be said.
It's a little bit outside the purview of Sandman, but have you read Lucifer?
Oh, yes.
By the end of this conversation, I want to make a bet. By the end of this conversation, I'll have done something that's not in your book.
Yes.
Lucifer is the cockiest, most awesome devil ever.
Because it's David Bowie.
Yeah.
Great.
Exactly. Yeah, he is David Bowie to a T. It's amazing.
That's, but I think, probably one of my favorite kind of characters to come out of Sandman was.
But that brings us to our final member of the Endless, the Prodigal. Destruction. Imagine a big fucking Scotsman with a huge beard. Nicest guy you've ever met, though.
Yep.
Even when he's carrying around his giant freaking sword, you know?
In my opinion, the most interesting.
Oh, yeah.
The Endless,
300 years before the events of the comic, Destruction one day up and decides, I don't want to be Destruction. I don't want to do this anymore. So he packs up his shit, tells his family, and leaves. And unlike what you'd expect to be another aspect of Destruction would, you know, take his place, reality went on without him. Reality found ways to destroy naturally or unnaturally on its own. Destruction is the least tied to his actual office. In fact, rather ironically, Destruction spends 300 years wandering the world and taking up various non-destructive pastimes. Like, he became a street painter at one point, an artist, you know, a poet. But the thing is, he loves doing it, but he has no natural talent because he is Destruction. Destruction is not meant as, you know, a counterpoint to creation. It is just Destruction.
Like, he was given one specific purpose in life.
You have one job, here it is. Yeah.
Even though he tried to do other things, he was just, there was something missing. But as well, as you say, what I always found interesting about this was Destruction up and left. So the aspects of the universe which was governed by Destruction, you know, the end of things, that was essentially gone. Which kind of brought up a very interesting philosophy to me.
Yeah.
Which was like, just by its own existence, and the other endless as well. So the other aspects of existence being destiny, death, dream, etc. They all just lead to destruction naturally. It kind of wasn't needed. And that's kind of bared out by the fact that he just quit. And he's,
in reality, you know, moved on without him, you know?
Living in a log cabin with his little pet. Right.
Yeah.
But when you see him in a flashback, it's exactly what you think. It looks like Brian Blessed. You know, huge beard, lots of hair, big axe. He's got like armor on. And the second time you see him, he's got his hair all slicked back in a ponytail, he's shaved, living in a log cabin by a stream.
With a talking dog.
And it's just like, yep, yeah, this is my life, and I'm really enjoying it. And at that point, I think Dream and Delirium,
yep,
if I'm right, they come and try to, you know, get him to come back to his job. But he's just like, no, I'm fine.
Well, actually, it was more Delirium wanted him to come back to the family, not his job.
That's true, yeah.
Well, she missed her older brother.
Yeah, that would have meant like, well, I've kind of got to come back to the fold, and I really don't want to do that. Because the family, it's kind of messed up. Says as much, and he says to Dream, "You're a real arsehole, you know." Dream basically says, "Well, yeah, but I'm trying to change and stuff." And Destruction says, "We're all capable of change, just whether we stick by it."
Like I would really be hard pressed to say which is more down to earth, death or destruction.
Yeah,
which is really funny because those are the two you would expect to be not.
You'd expect them to be the most barbaric, I guess.
Yeah,
or just the most.
And I think one thing about destruction that really does need to be brought out there, because it is outside of what you'd expect. Destruction loves his family.
Oh yeah,
even Desire, and nobody fucking likes Desire. And he's the only person they say that is able to talk to Desire out of her stupid schemes. Just by being level-headed.
It just, like, you can kind of tell it's one of those things where, again, going back to the relationship thing, he got away from his family because he knew that they were ultimately, pardon the pun, destructive for him.
Yeah.
And maybe that was just an aspect of, you know, of him. Destruction, this is what he has to deal with. So, in order to get the best peace of mind, he just has to go away. But I mean, it's interesting to note that he's like, again, the one that kind of binds them all together. Even as level-headed and...
Yeah. Now,
calm-minded as death is.
Yeah.
He's not a patch on destruction.
Now, I got a question for you. Really, when you think about it, did he view his inclusion to the family as being a destructive influence, like, on them? Or did he feel that they were a destructive influence on him?
I think it was both. I think he was just like, no matter what happens, me being here isn't going to be good for me or them. And it turns out it just wasn't good for them as opposed to him. It was fine for him to leave in the end. You know, he's great. For the family, though, and what happens throughout the course of the comic... maybe it would have been better if he'd been around, but to be honest, events probably would have been largely the same. You can't beat destiny.
Yep. Now, that brings us to our addendum of the Endless, the second dream, Daniel. Spoiler alert, Morpheus dies. I'm not going to say how, because I want you guys to actually read this comic. But Dream, when he dies, is taken over by a new aspect, which was a child that had gestated for 2 years in the dreaming realm. Now, I'm not even going to bother going into the kid's character because he was like 3. He didn't have much of a character. Daniel, the second dream, Moore brings up a really interesting point about the Endless. When one of them dies and a new aspect takes over, they immediately gain the sum total of the last incarnation. All the memories, all the thoughts, all the powers. It's less, it's a different person and more almost like here's a different viewpoint. Because that's all the Endless are in the end. I think you'd agree, John, is their viewpoints.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that kind of gets... given that they're anthropomorphized, they're personifications of different aspects of reality or existence, if you will. The thing that was ultimately the downfall of Dream was his human side. Him wanting to be a better person. Him wanting to make things right. That was what led to his downfall. And now it becomes when Daniel takes over, when Dream dies. He's been a human from life. He was born, raised as a person. All of a sudden, it just becomes Dream, becomes a new personification of dreaming. And that aspect, I think, is really just a really important kind of development, because it not only is it a very literal, like, embracing his human side, but passing it on as well. And in the end, it's voluntarily. You know, he passes it on to his, for all intents and purposes, his son. And gives him all this knowledge, knowing that he'll do a good job, and knowing that he'll be a better Dream because he's embraced his human side.
Exactly. He's, you know, calmer, he's softer in his approach, he takes the time to talk to the individual Dreams. To, you know, to see what they're thinking, which Morpheus always was very, you know, arm's length kind of guy. And anytime you got closer than arm's length, something very bad usually wound up happening to you, you know. Like, you spend 10,000 years locked up in hell.
Yeah, that was not a good... No, that was not a good time for anyone.
Yeah. Or your entire civilization crumbles. And death actually hints that even worse things have happened from getting too close to Dream. But Daniel, he's more human, obviously. And kind of represents, well, as these are all, like we said, more or less viewpoints, Daniel represents a change in the viewpoint. To say that Dreams don't need to be hard, you know, hitting, you know, soul-crushing and all these negative things. Dreams can be intimate, can, you know, show you, you know, as well as... In Daniel's case, he's learning from Dreams. Both literally and metaphorically. I mean, he asks, you know, Lucian his purpose kind of thing. To learn who he is. Whereas Morpheus be like, I created you. This is your function. You know? Dream was a stodgy bastard. Daniel was... a softer, more human take. But yeah, I'm sitting here racking my brain, trying to figure out where to go, because we only have so much time, you know? But I think we need to talk about the dreaming.
Yes.
Dick, as the outsider of the group who hasn't read this so many times that the pages are falling apart, what did you think of the dreaming?
Oh my god, the ideas displayed, the art, the overall concept of this land built of dreams and things like that, and that affecting reality and things like that. Just all of that combined together and everything, it very much lines up with a lot of things that I've been interested in regarding lucid dreaming and things like that, just in my private life personally. So it was very interesting to see all of these concepts and ideas borrowed from not only science that's been done about this, but popular mythos and things like that, and see how all of these things were woven in together within the dreaming. It was very interesting. I liked it a lot. It was definitely we're talking about Dream's Realm, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Definitely the architecture was just some of the stuff that I've actually seen in dreams that I've had before. For example, I had a dream once where I walked and there was this castle that was just absolutely impossible. It shouldn't have been able to exist, you know? And I love artwork like that, and I think that was really well conceived, all of the areas of the dreaming and everything were well written. You know, there's that giant field of bones during when we find out what cats dream about, which is a very good storyline, one of my favorites, actually. Just every single detail, all of the bits and pieces and various bits of mythos that were picked up and put together and woven together into this seamless image, it's done very well, and it almost in a way explains all the various mythos that are out there in the world without disrespecting any of them, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, like that goes in the idea, like there's three characters in the dreaming: Cain, Abel, and Eve. The question comes up at different points of the book is, are they the real Cain, Abel, and Eve? Or are they just the manifestations of the stories that sprung up from the Christian mythology?
Exactly, yeah. It brings that interesting question there of whether or not, you know, mythos and things like that, are those just not dreams as well, but in a different way, sort of? And it's very interesting how it looks at that. That was definitely one of my, those are definitely some of the more prominent themes. And I don't know, it was very interesting to just take a look at this dreamscape overall and just be able to sit in awe and look at just gorgeous panels. Like everywhere there is just beautiful. Even when it's in ruins near the beginning, I loved it. The colors are great. The line work is fantastic. It's not terribly clean in its execution, but I think that very much lends itself well to the very chaotic nature of dreams and the very roughness that it is. It's not so much that it's bad line work. It's just not as heavily defined as, you know, say, like a Captain America comic.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, while we're on the topic of the dreaming, I think we need to stop and talk about two very important characters of the series: Matthew and Lucien. Matthew, as John mentioned before, is the latest in the long line of ravens, which are pretty much personal couriers and, you know, servants of Morpheus himself. Matthew started life as an actual person before dying and becoming a dream raven. And he still remembers being human. He's got a very human character to him. And at certain points in the story, he not only acts, you know, as a courier and messenger, but they kind of showed that he's one of Dream's very few actual friends. Somebody who can stop, look at him, and be like, are you fucking stupid? That's a bad idea. Think about it a little more. And unlike most people, Dream would sit there, think about it for a minute, and listen. You know, so he worked as an advisor as well. It's like, the Raven has a very interesting situation in the story. Supposed to be subservient to Morpheus, but acts almost like his conscience. I mean, do you get the same feeling, John?
Absolutely, yeah. Basically, just, like I say, it's his best friend, and is the kind of person that you can always turn to and be like, do you think I should be doing this? And it's not going to bullshit you. It's going to go, my lord, that is a dumb idea.
I mean,
Dream always needed that as well, because Dream is so just, no, I'm going to do this because I'm right. And after the events of the first comic book, where he gets captured and everything, he kind of realizes his own failings. Takes his opinion a lot seriously at that point.
And like when Dream went to go face the Furies, and Matthew's just like, no, I'm coming with you. He's like, I need you in the castle. He's like, no, you're my friend. I'm coming with you. Which was, you know, a lot of strength of character that, I'm going to say flat out, none of the other Dreams had.
No, not at all.
And he has, Matthew has his own character arc in the end, where he sees, you know, he knows Dream has died. And he almost kind of, in a way, blames Daniel and says, you know, I'm not going to support you. I want to be unmade, you know. But eventually turns around, softens his stance and says, no, you're still Dream. You still need me as much as I need you. And I think that was a really touching kind of change of character. But yeah. The other one I want to talk about, though, Lucien has the coolest role in all of the Dreaming. The Dreaming not only encapsulates the actual dreams we have, but the dreams we abort, which in this case means a library full of every book never written. Every abandoned plotline, every, you know, story that somebody wishes they'd wrote and never did is in this library. And it's huge. Like, several points during the story, you hear Lucien talking about having to expand the library just to get all these books in place. So, I mean, could you imagine somebody who writes as much as, say, Stephen King, how many books he didn't write? You know? Yeah. Jeez. I mean, that fucker probably has his own wing, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, no, Lucien is definitely one of the more interesting aspects of the whole idea of dreaming and things like that, and how, you know, a lot of times people will take inspiration from their dreams and things like that. And I find it interesting how Dream feels it necessary to archive all these things, only because he needs to know about all of his realm. And in a way, what those plots are part of his realm, and that these are storylines and things like that could potentially take place in a dream, and he needs to be aware of these things. And it's also just interesting because you know all the time people have ideas for things, whether it's an actually good idea or not. People have ideas about, oh, it'd be cool if they made a TV show about, you know, the Terminator, but if he was Thor. And, you know, it, like, that's a really dumb idea, but, you know, it never got made, so at least someone, you know, someone wrote that book, as it were.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm getting at. It's interesting to see him not want to lose even the most outlandish of ideas.
And then let's just give a quick, well, not quick, but a minute to bask in the glory that is Mervin Pumpkinhead. I mean, just the funniest fucking character in The Dreaming. He's a scarecrow that likes to smoke cigars and likes to call people names and likes to just be the most cynical bastard he can be.
He's also got a pumpkin for a head.
Yep. And the pumpkin moves.
Yep. The pumpkin is not stationary.
He works almost like as a groundskeeper. But not a very major character, but every time he's on the page, I usually found myself with at least a smirk, you know?
Yeah, he was definitely much needed comic relief in a sense that he was a character you could insert somewhere into The Dreaming to diffuse either, you know, the very, what I would consider small climaxes of the somewhat arcing storylines that happen. That there's not, you know, very big peaks and valleys, as it were, but it's a nice way to kind of round things out like that, either, you know, during downtime or after a big thing. And he's a very interesting little device to just kind of reset the whole situation and allow the story to progress by using humor as a literary device.
Yeah. But honestly, Merv is my second favorite dream. There's only one that I feel is better than him, and I feel a sentimental attachment to it, and that's Gilbert. Fiddler's Green?
Yes.
Great character.
Fantastic character. Definitely interesting that a dream of a place wanted to be a human being and wanted to live like a mortal. I love that. It's such an obscure, weird idea, and yet if you think about it, you places don't get to be people, and it's a very weird thing to think about, and you kind of have to almost smack your brain against a metaphorical wall to kind of wrap your head around it. But I liked it. I definitely thought that Gilbert was one of the more interesting uses of Dream's ability to create things.
It's interesting you bring up those two characters actually one after another.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end, there's kind of like this attack on Dreaming. And both Merv Pumpkinhead and Fiddler's Green sort of are part of that final battle.
Yep.
And the new Dream, Daniel, when he gets control of the Dreaming after everything, I was right. The ones that died, I'm going to recreate them. He creates Merv Pumpkinhead. Merv Pumpkinhead's like, oh, great, fantastic. I'll get back to work. Smokes a cigar. He recreates Fiddler's Green. And Fiddler's Green just goes, what are you doing? I died. Well, no, I just made you here again. It's fine. There's no, I'm not the same thing I was. It's not the same. I'm not. I don't have his memories. You can put them in me, but they're not really mine.
That, and he says straight out, I had my time, you know? I had a death that had meaning. I had a life that had meaning. Please, just let me die. You know? That was a real hard scene to read.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, instead of, you know, I'm going to switch things up. Instead of talking about Lucifer as a character, Sandman has a very interesting narrative style. It's not one linear story. It is really a collection of stories in and out of order, you know? It's more about the stories as opposed to the story, you know? Yeah, it's about the mythology. It's about the theology. It's about, you know, a fucking William Shakespeare, Aleister Crowley, you know, it's about perceptions and the individual stories. Yeah.
There's kind of a main story.
Yeah.
Sort of. Not like,
it's more of
it's quite hard to pin down what the actual story is. There's the start of it. There's kind of a middle of it and there's kind of an end of it. But interspersed throughout there's like flashbacks to ancient Greece. There's side stories with characters that, you know, don't come up again. Like Lucifer, you know, at one point just goes, oh, I'm sick of being in charge of hell.
Oh, hold on. Don't get into that yet.
No, I won't. But that's just kind of like what it says. And then the fallout is, you know, what other characters have to deal with. But it's just like, all these weird stories cutting back and forth, and you're never really sure what goes where, especially on the first read. Dick, I don't know how you found it to read, but like when I read it for the first time, I was just like, "What is going on here?" And it wasn't.
I was a little confused. I'm not gonna lie. I definitely had a little bit of trouble, and then I went and actually thought about it for a second about halfway through the read, and I was like, oh, actually, no, this makes a lot of sense because he is one of the Endless, so he's timeless as well. So all of these memories being in and out of order like this and all of these sorts of things like that, it doesn't matter because that's how time is probably perceived by a being that is considered infinite, someone that is an immortal, you know, very necessary part of the fabric of existence, as it were. And how it's interesting how even those sorts of things can die and be reborn. It's very interesting looking at that as well. But no, the way that everything was laid out and flow-wise made sense to me, just because if you look at it, he is a timeless concept. So regardless of them being out of order, what Neil really manages to do here is show you all of these concepts and try to sort of dissuade you of your fears of them, because they're not nearly as inhuman as you think they may be. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm. Yeah, that's the only way I can put it. It's like you've nailed it, and actually thought further into it than I did. But yeah, instead of talking about Lucifer, let's instead start with a little quote and see how badly John completely just pisses himself.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this.
To absent friends, lost loves, old gods, and the season of mist, and may each and every one of us always give the devil his due.
Yes! I love it! But every time I hear that quote, it's just, oh my god. I can't describe how much joy it fills my heart with.
Yeah. Season of the Mists. Oh, God. Okay. Remember how I said Destiny really works more as a plot device?
Yep.
So, Destiny calls a family meeting with the statement that I am only to bring you here. What will come of it? is what was meant to come of it. I am only here to bring you all to my house, you know? And then it turns into a sibling bickering, you know, with Desire, because Desire's a cunt. Brings up that 10,000 years ago, a mortal fell in love with Morpheus, and he fell in love with her. And she wound up, you know, denying him, saying that it's not meant for man to become like a god. So Morpheus, in his infinite fucking wisdom, says, okay, if you're not going to be with me, I'm going to sentence you to hell and destroy your entire area. Pretty dick move, right? Well, yeah. Desire decides to go, hey, remember what you did to her, you prick? And, you know, Dreams kind of gets, you know, standoffish and defensive. Until Death turns on and goes, you sentenced her to fucking hell, you asshole. To which point, Morpheus decides to stop being a little bitch, go to hell, and free his former lover. Well, doesn't work that way. Morpheus goes to hell to find Lucifer sending all of the demons and the damned out the gates. And bids Morpheus to walk with him as he finishes up, you know, getting the stragglers out. Morpheus is just like, what the fuck are you doing? This is hell. We need this, you know? This is penitence. And Lucifer's like, I don't care. Not my problem. Here, have the key, asshole. Oh, by the way, cut my wings off so I'm mortal now. Well, semi-mortal now. And then, you know, Lucifer, as he does, goes off to hang out on a beach like a bum. Leaving, you know, Morpheus with the key to hell and the decision of what becomes of hell now that Satan has abdicated the throne. It comes to a really interesting point where gods and other figures are coming to the Dreaming to bid Morpheus listen to what they want done with hell. And, like, the fairies want hell left empty. The Norse want hell handed over to them so they can escape the Ragnarok, you know, events. All these people come with new ideas for hell, and Morpheus is just like, you're all just being selfish. And sits back with it. Meantime, on Earth, the dead are rising. Luckily, it's not, you know, zombie apocalypse, which probably would have been kind of cool, but I think how it's handled is better. I mean, the ghosts are coming back, taking up their old places in life. It's almost like when hell emptied, they hadn't learned their lesson. They come back and they're right back to being the same people. Which really kind of makes you sit there and wonder if hell is really effective at all at that point. But that's getting a little too esoteric for this. You've got, literally, like, the cast list is huge. Loki, Odin, Thor, Anubis, Bast, Bess, Susano, you know, all major beings in different pantheons across the world in history. It was interesting seeing them, you know, seeing Neil Gaiman pull out these characters who, yes, they were gods, but now they're kind of obscure because the civilizations have fallen and changed, you know?
I think it's probably where he got the roots of the idea to do American Gods from.
I would not be surprised.
Because it's just like it. Although it was like 8 years before American Gods came out, so.
Yeah, but I'm going to skip through the negotiations because those are actually, that's a reason to read it right there, just to see the different ways the different pantheons want to use hell, you know?
Oh, hell yeah.
No pun intended, I hope?
No, not at all. You know me and puns.
Yeah. But it ends with two angels saying the creator has bid that there must be a hell. And then, you know, he senses, I don't know if sentence is the right word, but he bids them, the two angels, Remiel and Duma, to take over hell. you know, to put the start the flames of hell back up and, you know, make a more penitent hell as opposed to just a fucking nightmare, you know? But Dream finds out that one of the many, many people among them, Azazel, actually has Nada, his former lover, trapped inside of him. And Dream, instead of saying, hey, spit her out, just goes, fuck you, jumps into a demon, and saves his former lover. You know, thus, kind of, I wouldn't say starting, but advancing the plot thread of Morpheus's redemption. You know, taking the woman he banished to hell and trying to save her from the literal hell he put her through. And it's a point where you finally see a little bit of humanity in Morpheus and a little bit of, you know, second guessing himself and going, maybe that wasn't right. But mostly that's the point where he realizes the actions were not commensurate. She didn't deserve anything that bad just because she told me no. I was a dick, you know? He apologizes to her and says, you can stay here, or you can go on to the next life, or, you know, anything within my power. Nada decides to be reincarnated. But Morpheus has to throw his little spin on it and says, you will always be welcome in the dreaming. Meaning, she can go back there anytime she wants. It's an interesting little, you know, advancement of Dream's character. It's tying up a plot line that had been dangled. But more, it shows the, like I was saying, these are viewpoints. It's the change of the viewpoint. I mean, I've read this, not just Season of Mist, but I've read the whole run, God knows how many times. And every time, more and more, that's what I see, is it's the changing of the viewpoint. Which, you know, in turn leads me to change my own viewpoint. And I'm thinking that's what Neil Gaiman really wanted, though. So, fucking huge kudos to him. Not only did he entertain us, he also made us think, you know?
Yeah, it's very much a Neil Gaiman thing. He'd only done a couple of things before this. Definitely a thing that made
him
big. Where he's doing novels now. They're doing an adaptation of Gods. Doing. Said they want to do Sandman movie, which please don't.
Please don't, no.
Don't even bother.
I can see the appeal. A movie about the Prince of Stories, you know? But at the same time, put it this way. The last time somebody captured Dream in glass, it did not go well.
Exactly. I think if you try and capture him on cellular, it'll have an even worse effect.
But yeah, I love what Season of Mist did with theology. And it was amazing. It's like, you're not sure, like, because of like things like Adam, Eve, and, or not Adam, sorry, Eve, Cain and Abel, you're not sure what, if the gods are real, if they're just another viewpoint, or what, you know? But then you have Dream meeting gods and saying, these are gods.
Yeah, and they're always kind of made to sort of go, yeah, you're gods, but we're the Endless. We're so much more powerful than you, because like, your power comes from people worshipping you. Ours just is. We will have this power until we're not needed anymore. When the universe ends.
Yeah. But at the same time, you have to, because, you know, you have the interdiction of the Judeo-Christian God. It really makes you sit there and wonder just where the hierarchy really lays. Are the Endless above that God? Are the Endless equal to that God? Do they fill different functions, you know?
Because DC in particular never really clear about how they first started, whether it was like a Judeo-Christian thing, whether it was a Big Bang, whether it was something. So that's always kind of left a little bit hazy. They never directly addressed Jesus or anything like that, which would have been interesting, I think. It would have been good to get a bit of Jesus in there. But given some of the events of especially, actually, which I hope we will get to talk about in detail one day, Sandman Overture.
I got to read that first.
Oh, God. I'll just say this, and that's it. It won't be a spoiler or anything, but I suspect the Endless would be infinitely more powerful than the old Christian God.
Really? I'm looking forward to that. Is an episode we have planned eventually.
Excellent.
Don't know when we're going to get to it, but we'll get to it.
we'll beat down the pile and then eventually we'll be like, oh, Sandman Overture, great, let's do this. That is only, I think that's only five issues, I want to say.
Yeah, five or six, I forget.
Really short. The art's J.H. Williams III. Oh, God, yes. One of my favourite artists ever. Most people's favourite artists ever. But yeah, like, that goes a long way to kind of show why Morpheus was, and a couple of other things that were, a little bit of questions left after the, always a good thing, I think.
Yeah. But, I really wanted to present, Season Miss as kind of, not stereotypical of Sandman, but the epitome of Sandman.
Yeah, for me, that and the first trade, mm-hmm. Preludes and Nocturnes, those two sum it up perfectly, because Season of Mists is itself like one contained story. But all these characters in that goes, relatively straightforward, brings in all this mystical elements, all these bizarre plot details, all this like amazing art. The initial one, the Preludes and Nocturnes, that is so, like, each issue is so different. One issue in particular called 24 Hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's a horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
It is so brutal and graphic. And had like three or four issues of like, oh, this guy's trapped in a thing and now he's got to get out. And, oh, he's a weird god. But it goes from like... a thrill story with all this like dark occult elements to an escape thing where he's got to track down his items that were taken from him. Got to get involved in Arkham and discover who's been like manipulating events in Arkham. Then it goes to this horror story, and then it ends with death being introduced. Oh, family thing. And it goes from one thing to another, but it doesn't feel like anything's out of place. It all feels like this works within this story that's been set up, and that's reflected in the entire run as a whole. You have issues which are basically horror films. For instance, Jason, the Corinthian,
yep,
is, oh yes,
oh, quite creepy bastard.
Quite a creepy bastard. He is, the main part of his story revolves around a serial killer convention that he goes to. But stuff like that, it's introduced, but, and normally it'd be like, well, this is just weird, why is this in here? But this, it just completely works because of how well it's told and how well it's written. It goes from that to, like, as I said, that ancient Greece, Rome, where, there's an episode set entirely in ancient Rome with the emperor.
Yep. It's
another.
I love that story too.
So good. There's one issue. One of my favorite is the character called Hob Gadling.
I love Hob. Great character. Amazing fucking character.
He's so good. He's a guy who's gone like, well, I'm not going to die because I just choose not to die. And Death and Dream happen to overhear this and go like, all right, I'll make you a bet. Don't kill that guy. And I bet he's going to want to die like in 100 years or whatever. And it's just like, it's him meeting, it's a Dream meeting Hob Gadling in like a pub every 50 years. And
100.
It's great.
100.
100 years, sorry. Yeah, every 100 years. It's great. It's just like, oh, this is amazing. He's met him. See how his life develops as he goes along, and It really fits in the themes of the book as a whole as well, like the idea of rebirth and the idea of accepting your place in life.
And Hob really is one of Dream's only friends as well. I mean, when he's getting ready to go down to hell to free Nada and take on Satan, or Lucifer, he takes the time to go into one of Hob's dreams and say, you know, I might not be there for our next meeting, but I wanted a chance to say goodbye and give you something nice. I mean, this is a guy who normally will keep everybody arm's length. He's like, you know, I'm about to do something risky. He's going to worry about me. I should probably go tell him, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, Neil Gaiman knew every fucking thing he was doing with this story, this series. I mean, you sit there, like, all these things that seem like non sequiturs, they all tie in. The minor characters you think are going to be nobody come back in a later story with a greater, you know, depth and weight. Even things, people you'd think would be throwaway characters, mean something. I mean, a pretty much throwaway character that Neil kills off in the first volume, Judy. With Dr. D, you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
While she dies, she plays on throughout the rest of the story through, like, her ex-girlfriends show up, people she was in contact with. Nobody lives in a vacuum in this story. And that takes some powerful fucking storytelling. To be able to bring every last bit back in and fold it into itself and say all of these people and events and how they relate to the Endless, you know? Like, I really want to know how much of how many of the 75 issues he had pre-planned when the thing started, you know?
I suspect most of it. It's probably like he had 90% of the story written and was like, well, I've got, you know, 5-6 spare issues, so I can do a weird Shakespeare thing there, why not? But even that feeds into the end, so you might have had every issue planned out, to be honest.
Glorious bastard.
I would actually love to figure out a way of reading it in what he would consider chronological order. That would be insane. Like, oh, that's where that goes.
Well, that's when I was talking to you earlier today, planning this episode, that's what I was talking about. I'm like, we could do it as a story, but I would have to sit there and put everything in order, and that's 3 or 4 days worth of work.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And that's like from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed kind of work. And Neil Gaiman just makes it feel so fucking effortless. That's why I love his writing, I love his novels, and that's what always brings me back. He can tell a deep, deep story with all of these moving parts, but it's only when you can pull back and look do you see that it's one moving organism, you know? And I'm be honest, I think that's something a lot of authors and comic book writers of this day and age need to fucking learn.
Agreed.
They seem to want to try and emulate it without really understanding the commitment you have to make to do that. Because I'm certain that this took like years.
Oh yeah.
For Gaiman to plan. People go into like, I don't know, Green Lantern, not naming any names, Geoff Johns, but they go in and being like, oh, I'm gonna do this amazing storyline that incorporates all this history, and then they kind of fuck it up and it's boring by the end. Or it makes no sense. That's the worst one, actually. Like, well, this doesn't make any sense.
Are you referring to the point where there's suddenly 7 Lantern Corps or whatever?
The Rainbow Rangers.
Yeah.
I most certainly am. Anyway, but like, it's stuff like that. It's like it's manufactured legacy or lore that they try and bring in. When Gaiman took the existing law from like basically every country's mythology on Earth. African law in there, there's like Chinese, there's, oh my god, there's an issue set entirely in Persia.
Yeah. Ramadan, right? Is that the one you're thinking of?
It's just astonishing. The art is incredible. It's just like the leader, the emperor, is just like, right, how do I maintain my city's prosperity for the rest of time? Green gives an offer where it's like, well, I could put it in this crystal ball and it'll be there forever, but no one else will remember it. All you'll have is like the dreams of it. And it's got this big, this like idea of that's just one, it's completely in line with the character because he would do that because he's kind of a dick. But two, it's like incorporating this other like area of mythology that no one would have thought is going to be in there. But of course it would be in there because it's every single mythology on Earth. It's everyone that's ever dreamed
of. And Neil even goes further and creates, you know, mythologies that don't exist, like the cats.
Oh my God, that is so good. Again, that's like, how does the power of dreams change the implications for it is just incredible.
Oh, I can't remember the issue name. The one that got me is the Do Cities Dream, you know what I mean? That one storyline. Yeah. Where he's like, you're in the dream of the city. And the guy's just like, it's not the dream of the city that scares me. It's what happens if they ever wake up. And it's like, that kind of mythology, we don't have that.
Especially as well when you're working in something like the DCU, where there's all this stuff. Like at one point, the Kryptonian sun is a character in it.
Yeah.
Like the stuff like that of like, do they dream and what are their dreams like? Get a little bit of an insight into that as well. Just a perfect blend of our current understanding of mythology and completely invented the way you tell that. There's not many ways to tell that well, but Neil Gaiman is the absolute hands down master of doing.
I'll go out there and I will say it. I think Neil Gaiman is probably one of my three favorite authors, up there with Robert Heinlein and fucking. You get my point. I can't remember the guy's damn name. It's bugging me now.
The woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey.
God damn it, you got me.
Sorry.
Vonnegut, there we go. Kurt Vonnegut.
Kurt Vonnegut, yes.
Only thing I could think of was Cat's Cradle.
Oh, yeah, it's a great book. Though, as well.
Yeah. But, I mean, Neil Gaiman's like, I hold him in such high esteem. And what got me into it wasn't his novels. It was Sandman. Like, I remember the situation perfectly. I was at a comic shop with this girl I was dating, and I was looking for something to read. And I was a fucking teenage edgelord. I was always picking up shit like Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which we're going to do an episode on eventually anyway. But, you know, I was always picking up the edgy kind of like Spawn and shit like that. And she's like, why do you read this garbage? Walks over to the racks and picks out Preludes and Nocturnes, hands me, goes, read this. I'm like, okay, this will take me like an hour to read. Go grab volume 2. So I came home with the first 2 volumes and read them in one sitting. And this is Neil Gaiman. That's hard to do. The man is dense. His story writing is just so dense and full, you know? To read 2 volumes back to back as a know-nothing 19-year-old, that says a lot, you know? And then from there, I picked up American Gods.
Yeah, I was the exact same. I read it, I think when I was, I was about 18 when I read it. And much like you, I was very into my, oh, I want some, like, goth stuff, man, this is great.
Yep.
But growing up, I'd always been a big fan of music. Dad had a record player in the living room. And used to listen to like old vinyl records with him. So I was very into like music of the 80s and 70s. And I read the first issue going, oh, this guy kind of looks like Robert Smith from The Cure. Great. Oh, that girl kind of looks like Tori Amos. Awesome. Then the moment I fell in love with it, it was turning the page and there was Lucifer and it was just David Bowie. That's what got me hooked for the first time. I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And it was that kind of surface level, like, oh, this really like hooked me in a little bit. And it wasn't until I got probably into the fourth trade that I was like, actually, this is just amazing writing. I read it. I finished the entire series in about 2 weeks, probably, something like that. And I've read it at least twice a year since then, because it is legitimately something you get different out every time you read. Much like we've talked about before, the best kind of books are like that. Best kind of books are the ones that you notice things, or you just feel different depending on how you're feeling at the time or where you are in your life. I've read The Sandman when I've been like really happy and excited about things, and it's got me excited for whatever I was doing. I read it when I went like to Ireland and moved to Ireland for the first time. I read it then. I was like, yeah, it's going to be great. And I've read it like when I've been the absolute lowest, you know, I've ever been in my life. I've read it when I've been just like distraught with depression and all this sort of stuff. And it's always just pulled me up a little bit. Again, it's the same words, it's the same pictures that you're looking at, it's the same dialogue, it's the same artwork, but highly reflective of you. Not just you, but you, how you are at the time.
Yeah.
It's just the hallmark of just incredible writing.
Now, Dick, I know your story here. You literally, your first encounter. Damn it, he's not even a... God damn it. But yeah, Dick's first encounter was literally when I handed him the comic and said, fucking read this was the show. But now, looking back at it, do you have that same kind of connection that we do to the story?
Honestly, yes. It definitely feeds into the edgy teenage part of me that I definitely still have as part of my personality. I'm still gonna, you know, listen to Marilyn Manson and be a total edgelord every once in a while because it's appealing. But definitely this is much more deeper than that. On the surface, it's very easy to write it off as just another try-hard edgy comic, but really at the end of the day, it's definitely just superb writing that wouldn't have worked as a book about the human condition and the various inevitabilities and eventualities that you will run into within your life. And that's what I really like about it, is that it's very much a novel-worthy story, but turned into a graphic novel, and it benefits from the fact that it has graphics along with it, rather than being just text on a page. Without the art style, without the way that the panels are laid out, without the way that the liberties are taken with art style when dealing with various, even just story arcs, I don't believe that it would have been nearly as good.
Okay.
I love it. I love it. It's so good. Go read this, everybody, please.
Yeah.
Do it. Do it. Go read it right now.
I mean, I can think of no other single comic that has touched my life, and I think I'm even talking the same for John here.
Without question, I've got a half sleeve tattoo because of this comic.
And I will fully admit, I am debating getting a Sandman tattoo at some point myself. I just haven't quite nailed down what I want.
Dude, after this, I need to show you the same artist who did mine did a Delirium tattoo that's out of this world.
Oh. See, Delirium is one of the ones I was actually thinking about getting, because, let's face it, mental illness is a very large part of my life. In fact, this is the only thing I'm capable of doing, is just sitting here and being, you know, a comic geek.
Hey, and you're the best of it, man.
I'll try. But yeah, holy shit, we ran long tonight. You know what? I don't care.
If there's anything we're going to do, it may as well be Sandman.
Yep. Balls out, right? But yeah, I think I speak for everybody here when I say this is definitely something people should read. Not just comic fans.
No, even if you aren't a fan of comic books, even if you don't enjoy the format for whatever reason you possibly could possibly pull out of your ass for not liking comics, go read this. It is literally amazing. It is one of those timeless stories that definitely, it's great. It is an interesting, very abstract look at your place in the universe, and I think you should go read it to try and get a better grip on where that is.
And if you're one of those people that, I mean, it was more prominent in the 70s, 80s, 90s, etc., less so now, who sit there and say comic books cannot be art. I would smack you upside the head with my copy of Season of the Mists. I mean, you ever want, you know, a defining point where you can say comic books are and can be art? It's Sandman. I mean, there is so much... I don't want to use the word art again, but there is so much there that, you know, it straddles the line of visual art, the written word, and it makes the two of them come together in just the perfect way. It is, to me, the defining argument for comic books as art. So, yeah.
So, the only comic ever to win a World Fantasy Award.
True. Very true. So, yeah. If you're in any doubt, go pick up Preludes and Nocturnes, and if by the end of it, you are not hooked enough that you're ready to run out and buy the second volume, I will personally show up at your door and punch you in the genitals. This is, like, I can't tell you how many people over the years I've suggested this book to, and not one of them have come back with anything less than that was, you know, one of the best things I've ever read. And in fact, it's the only thing, only good memory I have of the ex-girlfriend that got me into it. She put me through hell, but you know what? She gave me Sandman. That evens it out in my book. I went through an abusive hell for a year and a half, but you know what? I got one of the most perfect things out of it.
At least you got that. All I got was a t-shirt.
Right?
It's a shit t-shirt. No, like you said, this is one of the three books that I will recommend to anyone who's looking to get into comics. It is, and even if you're not into comics, I'm always like, well, read it anyway, because it's just phenomenal. And yeah, if people are like stuck up about reading comics or graphic novels or whatever, just give them Preludes and Nocturnes and see how their opinion is after that. Because 100% of the people I've given it to have loved it. That's comic fans, non-comic fans, everyone. Even my mother was like, oh, this is great.
Yeah, that's one thing I've always wanted to get my dad to read. Because you know, he's the one that brought the love of comics to me. I've always kind of wanted to sit there and turn to him and be like, read Sandman. And I'm hoping, you know, one day I get the opportunity to do that. But I think, gentlemen, we've ran a bit long, but I think we've said what we needed to say.
Exactly, yeah. I think everybody definitely needs to go read this, like, right now. Like, as soon as this is done, go figure out a way to get a copy. Please.
And please, I gotta say, like, our enthusiasm for this comic book knows no bounds. And that I honestly have to say, this has probably been the most fun episode for me.
Absolutely. I could talk... This is a pun. I could talk endlessly.
Well, to be honest, over the 2 years I've known you, how many times have we gone back just to talk about Sandman for no reason?
Oh, a million.
You guys did it the other day. Like,
yeah,
we were talking about something completely unrelated, and it ended up turning into Sandman.
But yeah, this has been Back Issues. I'm your host, Jason. With me have been Dick and John, and we will catch you next week.
Have a good one, guys.
Later.